This is Aiden Lohr with Oddball Pilot, sitting down with Dave Wewell in his house just outside of the town of Talkeetna. And we're going to sit down with Dave and sort of just talk about his career in aviation. It's been pretty diverse, ranging from smaller planes to larger jets for the airlines, then sort of back towards smaller planes. And I don't actually know a lot about his career. I just had a lot of people in town kept telling me that I should talk to Dave for a very interesting, diverse career. So we're going to start from the beginning, and I'm going to learn as much as you guys do as we go. So, Dave, to start with, when did you first get interested in aviation?
Well, my dad was a flight instructor, and he also was a company rep back in the early 60s, and he covered the whole United States, and he had bought a A-model Bonanza, 1949, A-model Bonanza, 1961. And at that time I was 13 years old, and I tagged along with him for about 3 years, all over the country, building up time, starting at 13, until I could finally solo for 200 hours, because he wasn't going to solo me before he could get insurance on me at the age of 16. So that was the beginning of it, and that was my interest with him.
Goes back a long ways.
Long ways back. In 1961, I was 13 years old.
So you soloed in Bonanza?
Actually, by that time, we had bought an Apache.
Okay. Oh, so you soloed in
I soloed an Apache in 1963, and I turned 16. And then after that, I did an Apache that we owned, and then I did a Cub at the same time.
Okay.
J3.
At that point, were you thinking that you wanted an aviation career?
No.
You just wanted to get a license and fly.
Just get a license and fly. And really at that time in the 60s, I hadn't really thought about a career in aviation. I mean, I was a sophomore in high school, so
okay.
I was still had no idea what I was going to do.
And where were you living then?
I was living in Massachusetts, but we were flying out of Nashua, New Hampshire.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So when did you start thinking that this could be a career?
Probably about in the mid-70s. I was kind of in and out of aviation, built some time, and then in the I had my private instrument working in my commercial, and then I had another opportunity doing my father. He had gotten a job flying DC-3s, and he was working for a company up in New Hampshire, same airport, Nashua, and it was a shoe machine company out of Nashua, and they had district offices all over the world.
Huh.
And a beautiful airplane. One about it forever. Belonged to General Chenault during the Flight Tigers.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And his co-pilot, kind of at the last minute, quit on him. And just before they were going to go on kind of a round-the-world trip. They were going to go to Europe and kind of go around through South America, and then back up to the States. And you know, at that time I didn't have a commercial. I was working on it, and he said, "Well, you know, my co-pilot quit. You know, why don't you fill in?" And I had a multi. I had my multi private, and
So you got your private in
right
Apache,
yeah. In 63. So he said, "Yeah, sure." I said, "You know, that sounds like fun. It'll be a 6-week deal." So I jumped in, went out, got checked out in the right seat of the 3, and took off on that trip, about 100-hour. Around the world trip in a DC-3, building up time.
Huh.
That was in 1974. So then I got real interested in aviation. Then I had a lot of fun. It was good, and I got my commercial real quick. I didn't get paid for that, of course, because I was just a private. It was a Part 91 operation.
Right. So your father ended up flying commercially.
He did. He flew air taxis. He was pretty interesting. He had flown during World War II, and then
okay. He
flew the invasion gliders, the Wacos. And then he went up through the corporate world, had a Lear 23 rating, one of the first people in the early 60s. So I took Lear 23 and flew freight when I had a first airmail contract. It was actually the first airmail contract on a small airplane
in
the United States.
He sounds like a whole other story.
Yeah, it was a whole other story. Quite a wide swath.
So when you got that first job in the DC-3, or not job, but the first around the world flight in the DC-3. Yeah. What were you doing for work? Did you go to college? Or
I did. I went to University of Massachusetts.
Okay.
But I majored in agriculture.
Okay.
So,
So were you working, because you were at this point, you were 25
I was in,
or so?
Yeah, 25. I actually was working construction. I was working, okay. I was working for a construction company as a superintendent out in Arizona at the time.
Okay. Was that something you were interested in?
Maybe it was.
Sidetracked you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a good deal. Okay. You know, when you're young, in your early 20s, it paid really well.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I enjoyed that. It was good. And it paid a lot more than aviation at that time. So.
Oh, so aviation really wasn't, you weren't really thinking it was a job till that DC-3
job. Not until the DC-3 job. And then I started thinking about it. And I stayed with that company 3 years. I stayed with them until 1976.
That was the DC-3.
DC-3 job.
That job. I got to get back to this around the world flight real quick.
Yeah.
What, would you know what your stops were?
Yeah, we had the airplane, like I say, belonged to General Chenault originally, Flying Tigers, and then it went to Air China. Then after that, Johnson & Johnson bought it and converted it, air research conversion, put in long-range tanks. And,
okay.
I had two-stage blowers, had the big engines, the 94 engines, dash 94s, had gear doors, retractable tailwheel. I mean, it was really
sweet.
I guess you would say tricked out. But anyway, we had pretty long range tanks. So we went out of New Hampshire, Gander, Azores, Lisbon, and then worked our way down over through the Canary Islands, Cape Verde Islands, back over to Recife, Brazil, Sao Paulo. And then one of the most, that was kind of pretty airways and whatnot, but then we had a lot of fun. We leaving Sao Paulo, we went, or actually, yeah, out of Sao Paulo, we went up the interior of Brazil and worked our way up into the interior and went up to a place called Rio Branco, which was right on the Peruvian border, and really interesting frontier town. And then from there, we went through the Andes over to Lima. And of course, we had the two-stage blower, so we could go to 20,000
oxygen. Right.
And worked our way through the Andes, which was quite interesting, through NDBs and kind of going through the valleys. And then went down into Peru, landed in Peru and got arrested. And, or detained, I should say. And we didn't, unbeknownst to us, we filed international flight plans, but they weren't recognizing each other's flight plans.
Yeah, of course you were with your pop the whole time.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and the people in the back. And but anyway, then we went from there up to right up the western coast of South America, Guayaquil, and then ended up in Arizona.
Okay, I've been through Guayaquil with crop dusters.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that was neat. I went 3 years with them.
Huh.
3 years with that outfit.
Your navigation was all NDBs. Even probably when you're flying in the Northeast with them, it's NDBs and VORs and
NDBs. And actually, going across the Atlantic, we had. A drift site, and what that was, it looked like a bomb site, and had electronic grids on it, just meaning that there are lines that were, and you would take a couple of different headings, and you would figure your drift correction on the white caps of the ocean.
Okay.
And then you'd figure that, and what you can do with three different headings, you could go actually on that back side of the ECXP that nobody ever uses, and you could triangulate and come up with your winds aloft.
Okay. And so then you could do your correction angle.
Right. We had Loran in that too. Loran wasn't very good. Loran in those days was as big as a TV set. I mean, it was huge.
Right.
And
whenever it snows, it goes out.
Right. So what we do, actually we would do mostly, most of the Atlantic stuff was dead reckoning.
Okay.
We would just go every 100 miles, take the winds aloft forecast and do a wind correction, and now and then take the drift site, make sure they were somewhere right. And we would be pretty darn accurate.
Right, as you got close, you'd pick up an NDB.
Yeah, you could pick up your NDBs. Like, you know, in other flights, I did some other in the Western, in the Pacific, and the same thing. You could get the NDBs quite a ways out.
Right, there's nothing to impede the frequency.
Right.
Huh.
They were good for about 400 miles. The big ones like Nantucket is a really strong one, or was. I don't know if it still is or not. Some off of Europe.
Huh. That's a great intro to aviation.
That was fun. Yeah, that was a great airplane and a great. It was a lot of fun.
And then you're flying the three around the Northeast primarily.
Northeast. Most of the shoe manufacturers at that time were either in the Michigan area, or most in the South. It was still in the United States at that time. So we went down into the South a lot and small little, the airplane worked out great because they were small strips, you know, they were, you know, 4,000 foot strips.
Right. Yeah.
In the, these mill towns. And, so it was a really good, it was a good job. It was a great intro.
Have you read Fate as the Hunter?
Oh yes.
I already got it. Yeah. He's flying the DC-3s around the Northeast right up there.
Yeah, that was, yeah, never had quite the experience as he did. But,
well, he did write for Hollywood also.
That's right, so he did. He did.
Huh, so, and after that, you were pretty much hooked. You were going to be
Hooked on that. And then that led into, we ended up buying, the company ended up buying another DC-3. And we bought that from a fellow named Basler, Flight Service, Warren Basler, out in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And so we're dealing with him.
Did he do the Basler conversions?
Yeah, he did, And then, so then what I did, I got hooked in with him, and then he was getting in the conversion business then. So he was bringing aircrafts back from different parts of the country, or world, I should say, to get converted. So then I went to work for him as a contract pilot, ferrying airplanes back to, or ferrying for them out or back from different parts. We did some out of Spain, and I did another one. The longest one I did was a Oakland Honolulu.
Oh, nice.
That was a delivery. So
you tanked that.
Tanked it, yeah. I made a lot of, about 2,000 gallons of gas.
Yeah, you need a lot.
17-hour flight.
So you ended up with a lot of DC-3 time.
I did.
Were you flying any other planes in those at the time, or just pretty much working in the DC-3?
I had a J-5.
Okay.
So I had my own airplane.
Goofing around with it.
Goofing the J-5, but mostly just the DC-3 and the J-5. Now and then we'd charter, or we'd, when that DC-3 was on one airplane operation, so we'd go and he'd rent Aztecs or something like that.
Okay.
And we'd fly those for, but,
So where'd you go from there?
I applied to a company called Air New England, which was out of Boston and Hyannis, and I got hired by them in 1978, and went flew twin otters for them.
Okay.
And I flew for them for 3 years, getting furloughed a lot, the usual airline thing, until 1981 when they ceased to exist. They went out of business.
Another danger of the airline.
Yeah. About the time, same time as the two things did them in. Deregulation more or less did. We had twin otters, F-227s, Convair 580s. And the deregulate, well, first we had the PATCO strike, which really hurt. But we were in Boston at that time, and things got really, you know, got quite fouled up.
That strike.
The controllers.
Reagan fired the controllers. Yep.
And PATCO, whatever that stood for, professional air traffic.
Traffic controllers.
Controllers. And the other issue we had with that is that we were an ALPA carrier, and that this is right in the beginning of deregulation, and the company had a lot of money. And actually, when I say they ceased to exist, they just went out of business. They did not go bankrupt. They had a lot of money. They just chose not to be an airline anymore.
Right.
They took their money. There was investors from Ford Motor Company, and there was some other pharmaceutical company. There was a lot of money involved, and they tried to expand into larger airplanes. They're DC-9s or 7-3s, they tried to negotiate with the union. And at that time, United, and this is when the flight engineers were more or less kind of going out the door.
Right.
And United had a contract with ALPA at that time that they had a flight engineer in a 737 that sat there in the jump seat and read instruments. Right. And they were insisting that we do the same if we were going to start up with a two-pilot airplane. And the investors said, you know, we have to compete with, like, Cactus out in Phoenix, America West, you know, and outfits like that who don't have the contracts, and we don't think we can compete.
Right.
So they said, you know what, we're going to take our money somewhere else and liquidate the airline. And that's what happened. They just decided one day, you know what,
we're out of here.
We're gone. So that ended in 1981.
How'd the Twin Otter compare to the DC-3?
Oh, I like both airplanes.
Yeah.
I love the Otter. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, boy, I've got about 100 hours in Otters, and they are fun.
They're a lot of fun. The three, both are fun. They're different, of course, they're totally different, but I mean, the Otter is a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with that airplane.
Yeah. Were you flying to shorter strips, or was it just a good plane at the time?
No, actually, it was just a good plane. Really, the airports we went to, we weren't using it STOL at all, and we were flying in and out of Boston and Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and all those types, and some places up in northern Maine, or Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont. But no, they were all, I don't know why they had really chose, I mean, that time we had Beech 99s too. I don't know why they really chose the Otter.
A little faster. Yeah,
you'd... Yeah. But the Otter, they had there was a bunch of airlines. There were a few airlines that had consolidated. They bought Executive Airlines. And, I mean, we're talking back in the 70s.
Yeah, and if nobody, you know, honestly, if you don't worry about going fast and your flights are fairly short, the Otter, you can put a lot of people in it and you can put a lot of bags in it.
The Otter was a good airplane. It was a lot of fun. I'd like to fly that again. That was a lot of good. Real good.
Yeah, I'd like to fly one again too, actually. They're hard to find than making them again, though, which is kind of
cool. No, I know it. Viking's doing it.
Yeah. So, I think people will start buying at some point. It might take a while. So when the airline shut down, so you're out of work.
I was out of work.
Were you thinking again airlines, or were you?
Well, I did. And about that time, this is 1981. And if you look at the hiring in 1981, it had pretty much dried up. There wasn't any. The majors weren't really doing much at that time. And I probably could have gone into, like, a lot of the fellows that were friends of mine that were there in New England and going into, the People's Express. That was when that was forming. And that was their main flow. And it's kind of interesting, you know, in any airline and airline jobs, it's served through my whole career is that, and I've been with 10 companies in my career, and that as a company starts to shrink and go out of business, that the people on the bottom go out first, right?
Yeah.
Well, they go somewhere, but now they're on top. So by the time the senior person is gone, you're working for the guy that was your FO. He was your co-pilot back a long time ago, and now you're his. And I've seen this absolutely multiple times in my career with people I know that we just keep swapping seniority
to maintain good relations.
Oh yeah. My advice I have two pieces of advice in the airline business. Is one is. Never, ever, ever piss anybody off. You got to see them. You're going to see them again.
And they might be above you.
And they're going to be above you. Yes, they even could be management.
Okay, well, it's funny, but Hagland Aviation, their chief pilot, I did his IOE in the Caravan.
Yeah.
And, you know, now if I want to fly for Hagland, I'm going to talk to him as the boss.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's a different relationship then.
Yeah. That, and that's my two pieces I give to newer pilots. To say, that's one thing, is never make anybody mad in the end. Industry, and the second is never cross a picket line. But other than that,
well, yeah, you're coming up on a lot of strikes in the 80s too.
Oh yes, there were a lot, and I had opportunities that I turned down. I had to
cross
the
picket line.
Oh, absolutely. I could have gone to work for the New Eastern or whatever, and I was actually my first first job I was ever. Crossing picket lines was the first job I was ever offered was actually at the controller strike. And so we shut down a week or two after the controllers struck. And the FAA came into our office, our chief pilot, or into our crew lounge, and gave us all applications. And they said, they were hiring us on the spot.
Wow.
You know, and put us in the tower or approach control or whatever, or center. And they said, the problem we have is that we have controllers that don't have any grasp. They're new, and these are all replacement workers. We have no, they don't have a grasp. I mean, they've been doing this in a little simulator, but when you have an airliner coming for Boston and you want him to descend, they don't have the knowledge to know that maybe he can't do this. He can't make this crossing restriction, and. They wanted to hire us to sit behind the controllers and tell them, no,
you can't do that.
You can't do that, Dan. It won't work. So, but that was the first time I turned down that job. And then,
those controllers that were on strike didn't come back either.
No, they didn't.
So that would be a little
They didn't even come back. I've flown with a few since then that were pilots that have gotten jobs. And
okay.
And I have friends that went, left, and never.
So where did you end up flying again then? It was 81 they went out.
It was 81. So. And so what I did in 81, so here I was, you know, I was making, you know, peanuts working for airline, Air New England, and even though it was a good company, I just never was able to advance that much because
right.
of the seasonal.
Well, plus,
so
flying, you know, the smaller the plane, the less you're going to make.
So then along about, I kept flying for fun, and then went back into construction. Had a very good job in construction in the West Coast.
Good backup job. For a
good pilot. Backup job. Really good backup. It was a great job. And making great money. And then I had, but I flew, you know, on the side, renting airplanes and all that. And so along about 1987, a friend of mine called me up, who I'd flown with multiple times and grew up with him. He and I learned to fly together. And he called up and he said, he was over at Continental then. And this is when Continental was doing a big expansion. He says, why don't you come over? He says, you know, you got your time, which I had a lot of time. He says, come over and, you know, have an interview. So he got me an interview at Continental in 1987. And I went down to Houston and interviewed with Max Jackson, who was an icon down there in hiring. And I sat down and he said, look, he says, I want to hire you. He says, you got everything I want, except he says, you're not, you know, it's not current in the airline business. He says, you know, you've got all the time I need and experience. He says, I'll tell you what you do. He says, I'm going to put you, I'm going to send you over to one of our regionals.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you fly there for 6 months and then come back. And then I'll hire you and go on a continent. So I said, well, that's a great idea. So I went over and he put me over at PBA, Province on Boston Airways out of Boston. And Ryan's at the time. So I went over there flying a 402. So,
nice, yeah.
Flew a 402 for them. And that was a lot of fun. Had a great time. But so, flew for them for about 6 months. And then the whole integration and consolidation of Continental started to occur. So by that time, the hiring had stopped at mainline Continental. So that was gone. So now what happened is that, and this is a long sort of story, I'll just make it as quick as I can, is that that Province on Boston and Bar Harbor merged, so I got pushed over onto the Bar Harbor side of that, and then on the integration they did was basically lay everybody off from PBA and keep everybody from Bar Harbor. And so at that time, I didn't have a diet furloughed again. So then I looked at the Continental Express carriers. Rocky Mountain was hiring, Rocky Mountain Airways, and Denver was hiring, and I was living in Tucson at the time. So I said, I applied back to them. Went over, I got hired over there flying an ATR. So I went, I skipped to Rocky Mountain, then they got absorbed by Continental Express, running under the Brit certificate. And I flew for Continental Express until 1994.
Okay.
But what happened in between that was is that Continental came in 1988, this happened with me, is they came in and they decided that they had a program in place called FMRs, which is Flight Management Resource. And what that was is a program that was integrated into one of the carriers that merged into Continental, People's Express. And what it was, they were hiring graduates out of the aviation schools with a couple hundred hours, and they were putting them as flight engineers into the jets with a seniority number. Well, then what happened was is these guys would become more senior, and they could start to upgrade into right seats, but they had 200 hours of flight time.
Right, yeah.
So what part of their agreement was is they would send them back to the regional carriers to get 1,500 hours of flight time and whatever before they could go back to Continental. It's called the FMR program. So they came to us, Rocky at that time, they came to us, and all of a sudden we're having these FMRs that were basically that we're training to fly, that we're giving them their between 200 and 1,500 hours.
You give them training so they can go back to the...
So they go back and be senior, yeah. So yeah. Continental said, well, you know, maybe what we'll do is, just so there isn't a lot of hard feelings about this, and there was other ramifications, we're going to give you seniority numbers, all right, at Continental.
Right.
So they came to us, and we voted on it. We were unionized at the time, in-house union. And we gave up a lot of concessions to get Continental numbers in 88. So we're accruing seniority over at Continental from the date of 88, even though we're flying it
Rocky, and then
Continental Express. Yep. So anyway,
welcome to the life of an airline.
It's like a needed roadmap. So in 90, I could have gone over to Continental. And that was the first time you could, what they call, activate your seniority. And I was a Czech airman living in Denver and having a loving life, making pretty decent money. We had a good pay scale.
You were the...
I actually had been on the 1900. I'd gone from the ATR into the 1900 to be Czech airman.
Okay. Which paid
well. And so I was in the 1900 and I was a Czech airman. And so I deferred Continental for 4 years until Continental closed the Denver base. And then I had to go somewhere. So I chose to go to Newark.
Oh.
And so I went to Newark for a year.
That's a change.
It was a big change. And so I was there about a year and thinking, you know, there's a reason I never went to the majors. And this is why. So I was an engineer in 727, so I didn't like not flying.
Yeah,
I just like to fly.
That's a classic plane.
Yeah, it was a classic. Great, I'm glad I did it, but I did it for a year. So then, two things happened. Continental was way overstaffed, so they wanted people to take a company offered leave of absence, and at that time I was still living in Denver, and I just was ready to go fly again, do something different. So two things happened. I was approached by a startup airline to go to work for them in a regional. And about the same time that I was offered this leave. So I took I was gone actually. I left Continental to go fly a Dornier 328s in a startup airline out of Colorado Springs called Mountain Air Express, which was part of Western Pacific Airlines. So that was great because I was a lead check airman with them. And I flew for them until they went out of business. And then we got absorbed. We actually got bought by Air Wisconsin.
So okay.
I went over to Air Wisconsin, flew for them for I think probably 6 months or so, and decided that it was time to go back to Continental. And by that time, I could hold a good position at Continental. I got in the 7-3, and so I went back to Continental and midnight. This would have been 99.
So when you took that leave of absence, you could come back whenever you wanted?
Yeah. Well, if there was a vacancy.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I could have stayed out for 5 years if I wanted to. I went back at 3.5.
And what do you fly then?
7-3. Okay. I went back to 737,
How was that to fly compared to everything else?
I had a really good time. I stayed at the rest of my career and I retired in 2007 when I turned 60. But I turned before the age change.
Okay.
But I enjoyed it. It was a really, really a lot of fun to fly that airplane. And we flew everything from the 300s to the 900s.
Did you come back as a captain then?
No.
Okay.
No, I came back as an FO and then upgraded after that.
Okay. Because your seniority number, did you have seniority to hold captain, but they want you to start as an FO?
No, I was just on the cusp.
Okay.
I probably could have. I don't know. I didn't want to be on reserve.
Right. Yeah.
I ended up at the end of my FO career at Continental. I was very, very senior, in the right seat, holding what I wanted, and I waited a lot longer than I needed to. I could have gone over a reserve a lot earlier. I don't remember the numbers now or when I could have done it. It was pretty close to when I went back.
Okay.
And I could have gone over as a captain, but
before we get in your post-retirement career, do you think your airline career is similar to what someone going to the airlines now would face with all the layoffs and not say layoffs, but companies going out of business? Or do you see a change with the airlines where they're maybe seem more solid now?
I would say, I think it's hard to say. I mean, I think it's a whole game of chance, that basically, I mean, you look at some people in the career that go to work for one airline and they're the rest of their career.
Right.
And I think that could still probably happen.
Okay, so it depends where you go.
It just depends where you are. And you looked at, when I first started my career and before deregulation and I had opportunities. Well, I'll give you an example. When I had, in 1963, I had my private instrument multi, and I must have been 18, or maybe 65. 1965 was I was 18, and I was approached by United Airlines because this is when the only real true pilot shortage there really was. That was because of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I still have the brochure. I was given this application, and they had kind of the same thing as Continental. They had kind of an FMR program. They would hire you at 18 and bring you right through the ranks, and you would have been and popped out the back, been there the rest of your career. And if I had taken that, I would never, and I didn't do it. I wasn't interested in doing it. I didn't want airlines.
Right.
At that time. So that would have been, I would have ended up with United from 1965 to, 42 years or something? I don't know, whatever that is. So that's an example. It's just a different road.
It's funny, because when I was fueling planes, learning how to fly in Eugene, it must have been 92, a Northwest captain came through in his own Bonanza, a really nice one, and he had gotten hired by Northwest in about 66. And he had gone from basically very little time, got hired, and like a year later he was a captain.
Right.
He never got out of the captain's seat.
Right.
Because every time he changed airplanes, he ended up in 747s.
Right.
So it could go that way.
It can. But today, in today's age, I don't know. I mean, it's just the economy is so volatile now, and it's just even right now, and I look at the merger of the airline I was with United now and Continental, and the people who are on the bottom, consolidation, they could be gone.
Yeah.
And they could be on furlough. United still has... there's still people on furlough there. Furlough forever. I mean, they've been there out for a long time.
Boy, I know a guy who got hired by FedEx 5 years ago. They haven't called him up yet. In theory, he's on their list to get called and one of the first, but they just haven't hired anyone.
Right.
So he's flying somewhere in Alaska. When you mentioned when you were 18 and got that offer from United, you didn't want the airlines.
No.
But you were going into construction about that point. You're going to school.
I was in college. I wanted to finish college.
Okay.
I went to UMass. I didn't graduate in UMass until 3 or 4 years later after that.
Okay, so you weren't thinking, you just didn't want, you wanted to keep, weren't thinking you wanted to keep flying, but not with the airlines. You were just thinking you didn't.
Yeah, I was just flying for fun then.
Yeah.
I wasn't really thinking about it. I had family friends that had been flying for the airlines, and I just wasn't. It was different.
Yeah.
A lot different then.
Would you say that, your background is pretty, DC-3s, Twin Otters, pretty hands-on flying, and now, or even back in 66, people are going from minimal time, new ratings, to flight engineer, to straight into the jets, and especially in this day and age where it's all computerized. Something I've been talking about a lot with Mike, my friend who's in this the website with us here, is kind of all this computerization and the fact that people aren't learning the basic stick and runner skills. Did you see any of that in your career when new guys might have been coming on and they just didn't have some of those basic skills that you would have gotten flying DC-3s?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I saw that. The first time I was really aware of that was probably when I went to work for Mountain Air Express in the Dornier. And the Dornier was a FMS system. And I was the lead check airman instructor with them. And we hired a lot. We were hiring, it's a brand new airline, it was a startup. So we were hiring a lot of people off the street and with pretty low time, because there was pretty good hiring. This has been in 95, I believe.
Huh. I didn't know about any hiring in 95.
Yeah. But we were having trouble. We were having problems getting people. And we were hiring probably fairly, at that time, I don't know, maybe 700 or 800 hours. I know it was fairly low times, but what I was finding was that even at that time that people were very fixated on automation.
Right.
They weren't some of the people who didn't, and we were, even though that was a very, very automated airplane, had like Primus 2000 Honeywell system in it. It was a really nice system. And we had heads up, we were actually working on a heads up on that. We never quite got there. We were doing an simulator. But I noticed that we were having some of the people that weren't working out, that they weren't stick and rudder. They were very inside the airplane.
Right.
You know, much longer than they, and here we were flying into pretty, that time, pretty, you know, Aspen and
mountain
airports. And then it was like, you know, you really needed, even though it was an automated airplane, you needed some really good stick and rudder. And I did notice that some of that was not working out, that there was, you're right.
So. Yeah, I can see that. And I've delivered some 172s with G1000s to flight schools.
Yeah.
And you realize people are learning to fly with G1000, which is a pretty cool system. Mm-hmm. But they all have autopilot. Because with these new systems, you have to, there's so much time spent concentrating your your systems that you aren't looking out the window.
You're not looking out the window, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the airlines, you know, is what's going on in the airlines today. And the 737, when I flew that, most of us over there, we would hand fly that airplane up to around 18,000.
Okay.
You know, just to, and, you know, but a lot of, you, I would see people, and I know some, they would sit there and flip the autopilot on. I can't remember, I think it was 400 feet or something, you know, and never, you know, you could go all the way to an autoland. Not that you do that. You just, that's a kind of a rarity. You do that. It's just low visibility, but still, you know, right to the ground, right to minimum. So you're hand flying an airplane for 2 minutes.
Yeah. That's what I did. We just wrote a little blurb on the website about this, but when I first got in the caravan and I was in COTS and there was a guy flying with Mike Spisak, Alaskan Island Air, I was like, man, I love this autopilot. You know, I sit back, do my paper, whatever. And he's like, yeah, well, just make sure you don't use it too much. He's like, if you always fly to your altitude, of course, we're only going to 7,000-8,000 feet. Mm-hmm. If you fly to altitude and fly your descent, you know, hand fly it, and hand fly all your approaches,
right,
you're going to stay current. But if you just turn that thing on every, as soon as you get off the ground, it's going to start sliding.
Well, you do. You see that. You see that a lot of. It's like you read some accident reports, and not airline accident reports, but you know, private pilots that are really relying way too much on automation.
Well, that's what sparked. I mean, this is kind of a separate discussion. That's what sparked this the recent post that we put in. There's been some articles coming out in the magazine, in some newspapers, and I think Sully Sullivan, who had that Hudson crash, went and testified in front of Congress that pilots are losing some of their stick and rudder skills, and that's. Kind of been talking about that quite a bit. And the ATR crashes, the feds have been, they've come with other reasons for it, but basically they stalled, and instead of pushing forward, they pulled back.
Oh, the Q400.
Okay.
The Culligan, yeah.
Yeah,
that, and actually even as much as the, I saw that article just last week, I think it was also the Air France.
Same thing.
You know, if you just...
And I mean, it's easy to speculate, who knows what really happened.
But, you know, you think, you know, if you, you know, set your power and you keep the airplane level, it's, you know, even though the instruments are telling you, and I know it's hard. I mean, I've had failures in instruments, and you want to follow those instruments, but there are some really back to the stick and rudder. But that they actually, the FAA, I don't know if the NTSB, I just saw the article the other day that said that where the proficiency of pilots is right now, the automated pilots that are flying automation every day, where they need to go back and
do
a little bit of stick and rudder.
Exactly. Go buy a Cub.
Let's go buy
or
a
Champ.
Or just do a simulator. You know, after the 737 problems with the rudder issues, we at Continental instituted a whole new recovery system.
Huh.
I mean, we would, in the simulator, we had to recover those airplanes from basically 135-degree, half upside down.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's what they were doing when the rudders.
Well, if the rudder, if you did a snap, well, you know, things, they didn't know what was going on those rudders at the time. So, I mean, it was great. It was unusual attitudes. And, I mean, really, you're on your back, almost in your back.
But really unusual, not just really your normal.
And had a knife edge out of it and, you know, not run a lot of Gs and take the wings off the airplane.
Oh, huh, that's cool.
So, but, yeah, they did that, and they instituted that in the simulator. And that was part of our PC here, professional check.
All right, back to your career. So you retired in 2007.
2007, right.
And how did you end up in Talkeetna flying a Navajo?
Well, one of the fellows that I had, his and I, our careers had followed quite closely from Rocky Mountain, Continental Express, Continental, and me, that he actually lived here. He actually homesteaded up in Chase in the 70s. Good friend of mine lives in Talkeetna today, and he worked for Continental. He and I are very close in seniority, and he said that it was actually interesting. It was absolutely a per chance, you know, in Viga Airline, you don't see people very often. They, you know, your paths are in different directions, but I just happened to run into him about a week or two before I retired in the crew room. He asked me what I was going to do, and I told him that I didn't really know. That that time I was just going to, I didn't know quite know what I was going to do. I know I needed to keep on working.
Right. Did you want to keep flying, or you didn't?
Oh, I'd love to, yeah, keep on flying. Yeah. But, I didn't really think that. I wouldn't mind. I thought of going back into corporate or back into the fractionals.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of that time, fractionals are hiring a lot of retired airline. So he said, well, you know, I live in Talkeetna. He says, you know, I have a friend up there that has, actually his wife had worked for Talkeetna Aero in one of the visitor centers. And said, why don't you come up and interview? So actually it was interesting. I had, my wife had given me a retirement party down in New York. And in the old airline world, of course, I couldn't get on as a non-rev. I was living up in Maine at the time. I couldn't get on an airplane because of a snowstorm. So we were taking Amtrak north, and the phone rang, and it was my friend. He says, how quick can you get up here to Talkeetna? I said, well, at first, I didn't know where Talkeetna even was.
But had you been to Alaska at all?
No. Never. Well, yeah, I flew to an Anchorage with Continental.
Okay, yeah. Yep, yep.
Yeah, Continental. We had a Seattle Anchorage run. I did a lot. So I knew I wanted to come up here. So anyway, I said, well, yep, I'll turn around. So we turned around, went back, and got on a jet and came up here and interviewed. And that was in March of 07. And I got hired. And I fit in good with it, with what I did, just because of the mountain experience I had. I'd flown out of Denver for years and years and years. And so that sufficed as an Alaska experience. This is history.
You got hired to fly the Navajo.
Navajo, yeah.
But you also fly the Turbo Beaver for Fly Denali.
Right.
Yeah, which are two separate
companies.
Deals. Yeah. Is that pretty standard if you're going to fly for one? Like if I wanted to come get a job for Talkeetna Aero Services, would I apply to Talkeetna Aero Services? And would it be understood you're going to do work for both?
It would help to do both.
Okay.
It would help to do both if you're qualified in both airplanes. We have pilots that just fly or are dedicated in each one.
Right.
But it gives you a lot more flexibility, or the company more flexibility, and you too, to fly both airplanes.
Well, your Beavers are all based up in Healy. Your Turbine Beavers are all based in Healy.
Healy, yeah.
And the Navajos and Talkeetna, so it would depend partly what...
But Talkeetna, the Navajos are both in both places.
Okay,
too,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Healy is our main base of operation. I'm the only pilot that's based in Talkeetna anymore.
Okay, so who's the chief, who would someone apply to?
Chief pilot is Trent Griffin, and he lives here in Talkeetna. And he's the chief pilot of both companies.
Okay, so that's easy. So
that's easy, yeah.
You really just apply to one person right. If you want to apply there.
But if you want to apply, he's the chief pilot, and then just the best way if you want to apply is just send a resume to Talkeetna Aero. And it's probably the best way. That's the corporate, and that's the bigger of the, in a way, it's the more corporate of the two. And if you send an application to them, that's and you know, if you had the Beaver experience or the tailwheel, basically tailwheel experience, Beaver's not that important. I guess the turbines would be helpful, and the tailwheel, of course.
Now, do you think they hire? Do they hire many people sight unseen, or is it one of those gigs where you really need to walk into the office and talk?
You need to talk to them.
Yeah,
there you know, because the business we're in, it's just like the business in you working with Talking Air Taxi, is that we're in a very unique business in that. We're pilots and we need to fly, but we're also performers.
Yes.
So and that is probably the harder hurdle to get over than the hurdle of flying the airplane.
Oh my goodness, that was a shock to me. I mean, I knew it intellectually when I took this job, but when I first got in for the first flight, like, oh my goodness, I need to talk for the next hour.
You're on stage. And that's something you have to think about too, because I mean, some people do not. You know, that's the harder part of the job.
Were you aware of that when you took the job?
I was, but I always enjoyed, I think I interviewed well in that because I like doing that anyway. Even right. when I worked at Rocky Mountain, we could still fly VFR.
Okay. Oh, nice.
In the Rockies. We did. Yeah. We were 135 just going in, everything at the end and going to 121, the 1900s and all. But we did VFR anytime we could. So that was fun. And, you know, so, I mean, you can't, being a pilot, you can't help but share. You know, you're flying over wherever, you know, and showing things off. So, I mean, I kind of had done that before. So, on an airline basis, or a regional airline basis. But that's something, a pilot who wants to do this, that's the huge part of it, is you're,
yeah,
and that's probably the most, to me, it's the most exhausting part of it. Is, I mean, when
oh, I agree.
I mean, the flying airplane is fine, but trying to keep the people entertained, and not entertained, but especially on the marginal days when there really isn't a lot to see, to try to come up with something that you're
get them
excited about.
You want them to enjoy the ride.
You want them to enjoy the ride. You're right, exactly, and it's really. That's the thing, you got to kind of go into this, whether you really want to do this, is there's a lot of flying out jobs out there that you can just put your people in the back and never say a word to them the whole way. Or
almost all of them.
Yeah, almost all of them. So that's the harder, and you know, you do 4 or 5 flights a day, as you well know, and you've talked for 4 or 5 hours or 6 hours nonstop. You're pretty exhausted at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's fine because I don't mind talking, but to do that when you feel like that's what you're doing is work, it's a lot. My throat would get sore, and but it's fun too. I'm in the 185, so it's really close. You're like the guy 5 inches away from your face. So what do you do?
That's right. Exactly right. To keep them entertained, and you're working for your company, and you're giving these people, they're spending a lot of money to do this, and you don't want to disappoint them, and you want to have them come away with a positive experience.
They're usually so psyched about it when they get down.
They're very psyched. So you know, when you're looking at that kind of, this kind of job, and I'm sure it's any kind of sightseeing or flight seeing business, it's you gotta go into it knowing that it's just not a time. It's not a time builder, I don't believe. It's just, unless you're this, you know, you want to be on stage,
right?
And you are. I mean, you're. This is we're flying an attraction. It's Disneyland. Or Pirates of the Caribbean or something out there. I don't know.
I mean, I've just been really pleasantly surprised at how psyched people are after a flight.
Oh, they are.
I mean, it's amazing. It's, you know, we've seen the mountains a lot, and it kind of opens your eyes up to them again, like, wow, this is a cool environment.
Oh, it's amazing. The flight we go up to 22,000 feet. So we're up at the top of McKinley at 22,000. And that's the other aspect of this, too, is you're up there and you've got... people are on oxygen. It's an unpressurized airplane, so you've got a lot of. You've got to be very aware of your passengers, what's going on back there.
We have a lot of older passengers.
A lot of older cruise ship people, and here you got them on an oxygen system, and you're doing some pretty good sized turns around the mountain, and so you've got to. You're trying to juggle about 3 or 4 balls in the air at one time, and then of course fly the airplane.
Right.
So.
How does flying the Navajo on these flights differ from flying the Beavers? And I'm sure there are a lot of ways.
A whole different tour. I mean, you're the Navajo. Well, first off, we do the Navajo IFR.
Right. So you're filed.
Yeah, I filed. If we need to.
And you at some point you have to cancel though, or not?
Well, that if we do IFR, just to see, We do it the. The regular VFR, like today, I did 3. We have a VFR exemption of 22,000 feet.
So
we just go up there and do the tour. There's a bunch of hoops. We talk to center and all sorts of things, but we basically can do it in positive control airspace and visual conditions.
Right.
Without a.
And you're not going to run into someone IFR.
No.
1,000 feet above.
No, they're limited. They're limited. The Iroka over the mountain is 23. And we have an exemption to 22. So we got 1,000-foot separation from the airliners arriving in the Anchorage. So, so you got that, there's about, going backwards, yes. So in the IFR days, when we take off out of here, out of Talkeetna IFR, if we have half the mountain, which the mountain's 20,000 feet above us.
Yeah.
As you well know, you're seeing most of the mountain.
Yeah.
And then same come back and shoot an approach back into the here.
Cool. So in some ways it resembles your airline flying.
Actually, the days I do at IFR is almost easier for me.
Yeah.
It is. It is. Takes a little longer. And I like shooting approaches. So it's,
yeah, and it's, I mean, once you're doing the same place, so you know exactly what it is.
And then you don't have to talk to it because you just sterile cockpits. So. Okay. So, okay, folks. And I just flip on the radio for them. They listen to what's going on with their traffic, and I'm in here shooting an approach. But, yeah, so you got to kind of go in with that eye. There's a lot of things going on. And you got to, I think the hardest part is to, especially on an IFR day or rural weather day, a lot of wind day. I mean, the mountain can have, I've been up there with 80 mile an hour winds.
Right, and it gets bumpy too with
a couple of ridges. Yeah, or not where to stay out of. And so yeah, the difference between the high altitude is a big difference, and the IFR is a big difference. The Beaver on the other side of it is, you're down in the lower turbulence.
Yeah.
And the snow and the glacier landings.
Right.
So the glacier landings and the landing on the glacier is a lot more of a challenge than landing on the runway.
I'll tell you, those days when the snow has been really crappy and I watch you buzzing around, I'm like,
Navajo. Like going up there tonight, two feet of new snow up there tonight. So.
Yeah. Back a little bit, maybe on a more personal level, and you don't have to answer this, but I know you're married to Vicky, who works at TAT.
Right.
Do you think the airline lifestyle that you've had is difficult on a marriage?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult.
Yeah.
It is very, very difficult because you're
gone a lot.
Yeah, you're just gone a lot. I mean, I always, you know, the airlines pay well, but I always told people that were going into it that they're paying me to be away from home.
Right.
I was gone 50% of my life.
Yeah.
For many, many years. I mean, I think it was 19 years just from the time I was 19 years from the time I really started with my last string of airlines. I think it was 19 years straight. And that's what I found is that you're gone half your life. And it's very difficult because, and I felt bad. That's something people have to think about. I mean, the fellas, by the time I went into it really heavy, my daughter was in college. So she was, I didn't miss the ballet and, or whatever,
Right.
And I watched guys, the younger guys that go into it, and women, I shouldn't say just guys, women. And what they miss seeing their kids grow up. And,
right.
And it is hard in marriage, and so you got to kind of weigh that too. It is difficult. You got to be aware of it, and I found the best thing is that for is your spouse if they have a grasp
of
what's going on. My second wife was a flight attendant. And Vicky was a station manager for Continental.
Okay.
So they know
it's not all.
They know it's about.
Yeah, and it's work and you're not partying. I mean.
This is work, and I'm sorry I'm going to miss the recital, but they just called me from Inward Reserve and I'm sorry and this is it. And there's no tolerance with the airline. I mean,
right.
You just don't. There isn't.
I'm sorry I've got to go to this recital.
No. Because there's plenty of people that want your job behind you. So.
Yeah.
It's a lifestyle, and that's, you just got to decide if that's for you or not. And I had a fellow one time at Checker Airman, actually a friend of mine, and he and I were talking, and he said, you'd think that, as pilots, we sit there and aspire, okay, the airlines is what we want to do. And then you get over there and say, why am I wanting to do this, and this isn't really, and he said, he says it's hard for a person once they get there set to say, this isn't for me, he says, and it isn't. He says, there are people over here who are absolutely miserable.
Right.
They thought they wanted this. They went to Emory Riddle and they did this and they sacrificed and here they are now. And all of a sudden they get over there and they say, oh wow, this isn't what I thought it would be.
That's a point that I've tried to make a lot because I've thought about the airlines. When you're flying out in Western Alaska, everybody wants, it is the end goal for most pilots who are starting out. It's supposed to be the cherry on the top. But you start looking at it, it's like, you know, it's not that good. Maybe some of these other jobs where you're home every night is better, or where you, you know, quality of life may trump.
My best jobs are the ones at regionals. That was home at night, that I was actually flying an airplane and going to places there where I liked. And that is true. That's true. And you gotta, as a pilot, you can't let that affect you. I mean, this comes from the day that you went to work for United or American, you know, at 21 years old, and they took care of you, and you retired at 60 years old. You had $1 million in your pension fund, and you lived a great life, bought the RV and the big boat. But those days are over. I mean, that is not, number one, you may go to work for a company and stay there your whole career. But number one, with the advent of computers scheduling, you don't get the days off anymore.
Right.
You don't get the vacations. Even though the contract says you're going to get X amount of day vacations, the computer makes sure that you don't get a day more than that.
Right.
And so it's not quite the, it isn't quite the, what it used to be.
And then there's uncertainty. I mean, you've seen Eastern and Pan Am go away.
Oh, yeah.
Which were, at the time, I mean, I wasn't that old, but I remember they weren't going anywhere. And then they did.
Right. So, you're absolutely right. So, it isn't for everybody.
Right.
And, you know, if you can enjoy, I guess it's the old thing with any kind of career, I don't care what you're doing, if it's aviation or not, do what you want to do. Do what you love. And
if you figure out you don't like it, then try to figure out a way to enjoy it, or else move on to something else.
And that's another piece of advice. The other advice I have to people, just younger people coming up, is have something else. You know, have something else in your back pocket. Yeah. Whatever it might be, kind of an idea.
Construction.
Yeah, really, that you can fall back on something and make a living.
Right.
If you had to, because otherwise, And I see some of the people that. The happiest. I mean, I've seen that. I have friends that are all sorts of different walks of life. That attorneys that have gone into flying, at least, than or whatever. And because aviation is a huge draw.
Yeah.
It's a huge draw, and it's fun. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the airlines, there are people who absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of, get that lifestyle, and you get your.
Well, they like the technology in the plane.
Technology is fun, and. And that's how I felt near the end. I mean, 9/11 changed the whole thing for me with the airlines, and it just became a lot of, not the fun it was.
Right, but just the travel is so much more difficult these days.
And that's what I told people that I enjoyed, is that once I got in the airplane and the cockpit door closed, I loved it.
Right.
And then everything before and after that, the cockpit door opened, got to be... just got to be hard.
Right. Just a lot of hassle.
And, you're always, so it changed the industry a lot. But I did love it. I enjoyed the job. It was a lot of fun. I was kind of sad. I missed the age change by about 7 months.
Oh, wow.
But, I wouldn't be here.
Right.
So I'd still, and actually,
liking,
I'm,
you're
I'm,
liking this job too.
I've got five more months, so I'm 65. So so I'd be retiring.
Right.
I'd miss 5 years of playing up here and flying the mountain, which I absolutely love.
And so right now you're up here in the summer and you go down to Colorado.
Yeah. But I don't fly down there.
Yeah. Just have fun. Yeah. But, cool. So I think we've covered everything that I can think of. That's great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's good talking. Yeah, so that's
that's it.
Yeah, that was a. It's been interesting. I don't know where it's going from here, but
I was gonna say it's not over yet.
Not over yet.
135. You can keep flying indefinitely.
That's right. I'm in good shape. So.
Yeah. That's actually, I wouldn't have guessed you started flying in 66.
Yeah. 63. 60. Yeah. I know. I still got my original when we used to have radio or telephone licenses. Is 1963.
Cool. Well, if you want a ferry fly, I've got I know some connections there.
Okay.
The guy I work for would love you.
I used to do that. I ferried, like I say, the threes. But yeah. I looked into that, actually. And at that time, this is in late 70s. 81. No, it was 81, 1981. And the company that, it was a fellow who worked for Beach, more or less, as a subcontractor.
Right.
And they wouldn't hire anybody without an A&P.
Oh, yeah.
He was doing King Airs and all that. And I don't have an AP, so.
They don't need that anymore.
No. They can fix them now. also, we ended up in, one night we ferried, it was DC-3, and he didn't have a type rating, so he hired me. It was his job, but he just hired me to be the captain, so I
could
think back. He never flown to 3. He thought this would be fun, so he went back to co-pilot. Long story, but, we landed up in Frobisher Bay up there in Northwest Territories in the middle of a snowstorm, and we'd already done a missed approach and parked there, snowing like crazy, and one of his buddies is there, I think it might have been a Bonanza or something, taking off in a Bonanza in a snowstorm, heading for Greenland.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the winter, it's like November. I said, I don't know if I really want to do this.
I did that out of Canada, Halifax or somewhere to the Azores.
Santa Maria?
Yeah, in a 172.
Oh!
I wouldn't have done that if I'd known how it was going to go.
Oh my gosh.
It went fine, but... Anyway, great. Well, thanks for the worst thing is I turn these recorders off, and half the time something really good comes out right after I turn them off.
Oh, yeah.
But I know you've got to get up and fly tomorrow morning.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to close out here. Thanks for sitting down with us. And Aiden with Oddball Pilot, signing off.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com, oddballpilot.com, for more stuff like it.